This program is brought to you by Resonance 104.4 FM. If you like what you hear and want to support our work, please make a donation at fundraiser.resonance.fm.
Freedom is an idea, but not an actuality. When we talk about freedom or think about it, we want to be free outwardly, to do what we like, to travel, free to express ourselves in different ways, free to think what we like. The outward expression of freedom seems to be extraordinarily important, especially in countries where there is tyranny, dictatorship. And in those countries where outward freedom is possible, one seeks more and more pleasure, more and more enjoyment, freedom to possess. And in the search for freedom, if one is at all serious, there is not only the outward expression of that freedom, which must, it seems to me, must come from psychological freedom, the inward freedom. And if we were to inquire deeply what that freedom implies, freedom to be inwardly, completely and totally free, which then expresses itself outwardly in society, in relationship, then we must ask, it seems to me, whether human mind, heavily conditioned as it is, can ever be free at all.
I was born with the taste of my mother's blood in my mouth. The poison her body manufactured during her pregnancy naturally saturated my tiny being. I shared in her feelings. As her body mutated into the outward expression of her worst fears, hatreds, and most pathological needs, needs that inevitably layered the chiseled contours of her flawless media star physique with slabs of fat and grease, so my own body, a parasitic tumor wrapped like a closing fist around her soul, grew in direct relation to the advancing malignancy of her disease, safe and feeding in the gentle folds of my mother's rotting core. Enclosed in the soft bone of my skull, my brain was an expanding, incandescent orb that filtered a dim, amber light out from behind my eyelids and showed my clutching paws before me, suspended in thick, amniotic liquid.
inwardly.
I explored the darkness of my crimson world, caressing the sensitive, fibrous walls of my mother's womb with my whiskers and hairless tail.
Both conscious as
beneath
well
the
as
water, I heard the lush, multi-layered tones of her voice, serenading me and drugging me, infecting my blood with
so
her identity. My heartbeat mimicked the beat of her song, echoing against the protective walls of her womb. My body fit perfectly inside the body of my mother.
Which is not put together
my
by
flesh, the organic, surrogate expression of the cancer hiding in the meaning of her song.
From the actual realities of daily existence.
As I fought my way free from the blackness inside her, I opened up a gushing sea of red with my razor teeth and claws. The sweet taste of oxygen mixed in my mouth with sticky pink jellies that tasted like cigarettes and cognac and cocaine and the salty sperm of the dark-eyed and muscular young men my mother continued to feed upon up to the day of my birth, nourishing her metastasizing greed, self-hatred, and me. When the latexed hands of the midwives reached in for my head to pull me free, I snapped at them, and I managed to slice through the rubber and into the meat of a thumb. They released me, and as I tried to scratch my way backwards into her hole, I screamed my first scream, a shrill siren of pure animal hatred and defiance. Then the forceps were cold and brutal as they clamped my skull, and I was pulled out into the searing blue-white light of the film set. High-intensity spotlights, chromium reflecting sheets, and both video and film cameras encircled us. My mother lay splayed theatrically on the white slab. Her eyes rolled aimlessly in her head, glazed with the religious ecstasy of her martyrdom. The marbleized reds and purples that pumped from between her legs were a radiant offering in which the midwives anointed themselves up to their elbows. They smeared their crisp white frocks with her sacred insides, like Dionysian priestesses reveling in an orgy of slaughter. I heard my mother howling beautifully, transported by the transcendent pleasure of release and the thrill of performing for the cameras. The surrounding crowd of managers, fashionable hangers-on, video professionals, and a cluster of oiled and shirtless young men looked on in silent rapture.
Not imposed,
rising up from my mother's exposed insides was a luxurious, opaque, purple vapor that filled the room with the chocolate-flavored musk of feces, decorated with an aftertaste of lavender and jasmine.
And one cannot learn.
Everywhere around us, video monitors showed close-ups of the wiry, glistening gray hair and the wrinkled pink skin of my face, caught in the polished steel forceps.
Not according to any pattern formula.
I raked the air with my jagged yellow teeth as I squirmed. Then I was passed from midwife to midwife, held up for everyone to see. Their long painted nails combed through the hair on my stomach, subduing me with affection. A few cameras panned back and up for long shots from above, showing the foreshortened midwives standing knee-deep in a thick cushion of dry ice vapor lit from underneath,
of beauty
holding me up ceremoniously over the belly of my writhing mother.
That's an obvious fact. Conditioned by the culture, by the society, influenced by various impressions, strains, stresses, relationships, economic, social, climate, educational, religious conformity, sanctions, and so on. And our minds are trained to accept fear, escape if we can from that fear, never being able to resolve totally and completely the whole nature and structure of fear. So our first question is whether the mind, so heavily burdened, can resolve completely not only its conditioning but also its fears. Because it is the fear that makes us accept conditioning. And if we may, this morning, please do not merely hear a lot of words and ideas which are really no value at all, but through the act of listening, observing your own states of mind, then we can together, both verbally and non-verbally, inquire whether the mind can ever be free from fear. Not accepting fear, not escaping from it. Not saying, one must develop courage, resistance, but actually be fully aware of the fear in what one is trapped. Because unless one is free from this quality of fear, one can't see very clearly, feel very clearly, deeply. And obviously, when there is fear, there is no love. So whether the mind can actually ever be free of fear, that seems to be one of the most primary, essential questions which must be asked and which must be resolved for any person who is at all serious. There are physical fears and psychological fears. The physical fears of pain, having had pain and the repetition of that pain in the future. The fears of old age, death. The fears of physical insecurity. The fears uncertainty of tomorrow, the fears of not being able to be a great success, achieve, and so on, not being somebody in this rather ugly world, the fears of destruction, the fears of loneliness, not being able to love or be loved, and so on. The conscious fears as well as the unconscious fears. Can the mind be free totally of all this? And if it cannot, then such a mind is incapable, because it is distorted. It's incapable of perception, of understanding, of having a mind that's completely silent, quiet. Like a blind man seeking light, and never finding light, and therefore inventing a light of words, concepts, theories. So how is a mind which is so heavily burdened with fear and with all its conditioning ever to be fearful? Or must we accept as inevitable aim of life? And most of us do accept what happened. So, now what shall we do? How shall I, as a human being and you as a human being, be rid of this fear? The total fear, not a particular fear, but the whole nature and structure. What is it? Don't accept, if I may suggest, what the speaker is saying. The speaker has no authority whatsoever. He is not a teacher. He is not a guru. Because if he is a teacher, then you are the follower. And if you are the follower, you destroy yourself as well as the teacher. What we are trying to do is to find out what is truth. We're trying to go into this question of fear so completely that your mind is never afraid. Therefore, you're free of all dependence on another, inwardly, psychologically. So we are taking a journey together, not being led. Someone ahead of you and you following in his footsteps. The beauty of freedom is that you don't leave a mark. The eagle in its flight doesn't leave a mark. Only the scientist does. And in inquiring into this question of freedom, there must be not only the scientific observation, but also the flight of the eagle that doesn't leave a mark at all. Both are required. It is both the verbal explanation and the non-verbal perception, bearing in mind that the description is never the described. The explanation is never that thing which is explained. That is, the word is never the thing. So if all this is very clear, then we can proceed. Find out for ourselves, not through the speaker, not through his word, not through his ideas or thought, to find out for ourselves whether the mind can be completely free. Well, shall we go on from there? See, this is not an introduction. If you haven't heard the first part clearly and understood it, you can't go on to the next. And to inquire, there must be freedom, as we say. To look. Freedom from prejudice, conclusions, concepts, ideas, prejudice. so then you can observe actually for yourself what is here. And when you observe very closely, intimately, is there fear at all? That is, you can only observe very, very closely, intimately, what is fear. When the observer is the observer. And we're going to go into that. So what is fear? How does it come about? The obvious physical fears can be understood. Like the danger, physical danger, in which there is instant response. It's fairly easy to understand, into which we may not go too much. But we're talking about psychological fear. How do these psychological fears arise? What is their origin? And whether they can end? That's the issue. What is fear? Fear of something that happened yesterday. Fear of something that might happen later on today or tomorrow. Fear of the known and fear of the unknown, which is tomorrow. The unknown being death and all the rest of it. We won't touch that into that question, go into that question
Jean
this morning.
2010, l'un du son des pois vifs, blé en herbe, cacao noir rare. Microscomos, le monde du vivant se partage entre les eucaryotes, les bactéries et les archées. Le génome du mimivirus invite à ajouter une quatrième branche à l'arbre même de la vie. D. Raoult, chasseur de microbes. Le Monde, 20-11-10, lu dans l'avion, direction New York City. Vert, soie grège, sol en ocre, pomme, if et des pies. Alors, J. Lys, des babas, un zinc, deux pies. La vie finit sur un soupir et plouf, le crématorium. Sujet brûlant, certes, mais il n'y a pas le feu. Hop, hop, Lulu, zoom, bis, 20, cire en noir, 10, if, D pour Dupuis, 67 deux fois. Texte de... Texte de ton ocre, bis, pourpre. Une main lave l'autre au sens propre. Nota bene, ces deux notes, c'est-à-dire Do et Mi. 10-5-1993. 38 deux fois lettres. C. Été 2009. Du coco, un grès, tutu bleu, un os et une voile ocre. Cette tuile, quelques lisses et un bois. Trois aphorismes de Georg Christopher Lichtenberg. Il avait donné des noms à ses deux pantoufles. Aujourd'hui, j'ai permis au soleil de se lever plutôt que moi. Cogito ergo sum, non cogitant ergo non sunt. Un baba doré et jus, pré, pois, if, mer verte, hachiche et du buis. Ceci est une équation, cher Lulu, 275 deux fois lettres, J Dupuis, le 38, le 31-8. En été, D, R, 141 deux fois lettres. Maïs, T, baba, kir, toiture en bois. Lewis Carroll. Toujours grave et pensif, les ordres qu'il donnait suffisaient certes à affoler l'équipage. S'il criait « Tribord !» toutes et tout droit sur bâbord, que diable alors le timonier devait-il faire ? La chasse au snark extrait. Fil fin, lin, terre, if, pi, cire en gris, fer, pré, os, coq, wagon bleu, J. Les phonogrammes, 189 deux fois, dit Pudu. 189 deux fois, lettres.
Let us not read too much into the titles of this session. June 6, 1950, Bird and Dizzy and Monk with Curly Russell on bass and Buddy Rich so out of place on drums. If Max Roach had been on hand to make this band hit with a different edge on the music. But that's jazz and the way it has to play with the specific individuals who'll be on the set that night. The music of the men on the stand and what we call it just does not matter. Bird told Symphony Sid in a radio interview concerning these sessions like he had no idea how these songs had got their names. He said, it's all just gone music, man. And I just called them rhythm or blues, and they put the names on them after I've left the studio. Monk, on the other hand, composed his music on his own progressions and fit the songs to the names he gave them. Such precision of rhythm and rhyme as we see so rarely. To take the hair off the sides of the head and leave just a strip along the top, sculpting all pretense for the baldness of statement, building a new music from the bones of the old, like Bird or like Monk, with a whole new structure of sound, breathing life of its own, like nothing that had ever existed before. Mohawk, Mohawk, Monk and Bird and Dizzy, creating a nation of music and chopping away at the dead flesh and hair and muscle and bone of what had been left for them.
Faite avec les 26 lettres de l'alphabet. Un mois environ fut nécessaire pour faire les quatre premières, or il ne mit même pas deux semaines pour les dernières. Nota bene, The Mind is a Muscle, said Ivan Rayner. Ivan Rayner. 10-10-1999 à Gigi Dupuis, copyright. C'est qui c'est Ivan Rayner? C'est une très grande danseuse de l'époque des années 70. Magnifique. Copyright, un baba, doré, pois, un vin, or vif, du son. Léon est bègue. Il est écrit comme il parle, ce qui facilite la résolution de ses textes AA anagrammatiques. En 1985, il a trouvé dans la rue une bague dont le sceau solitaire brillait par son absence. Et évidemment, ce cacao, figue, un nif, 4-5 pommes, été 2177 deux fois lettres. JD 147 deux fois, copyright. Quelques lys, mer, ce sein bi, la, canne, baba verte, ses herbes vives, vin, zing, pluie à pierre-feu. Le 16-10-2009, cette photo montre un tatouage fait en 1992 sur les bras de David et Stefano à la Galerie Galéa à Caen. Ces deux artistes ne vivent pas ensemble. L'œuvre n'est donc visible que sur rendez-vous. Par scriptum, je crois qu'ils habitent en Normandie. Pré, teinte, gris pâle, if, b, lune, fer, rat et h. pain, mine, mer, blé endoré, lys, suie et feuilles de tabac. Ce texte rare est une anagramme, 158 deux fois lettres. Léon se souvient qu'en 1992, il a trouvé sur une plage de Casablanca un tire-bouchon, sans doute très prolongé dans la mer, et poussé là, sur le sable, par un courant marin. Il a cru naïvement, Lulu, que c'était un message. Un bois, une voile ocrée, une soie en bistre, ale, cet if, herbeux, JD, été.
Yeah.
I have two questions. One, what corporations benefited from the takeover of the Wounded Knee land, of the Pine Ridge land, during that period, and the uranium mining? And secondly, what strategy do you see to get Leonard out of prison?
Okay. In the first piece, on Pine Ridge itself, the uranium was in the Gunnery Range section, the northwestern 1/8, half the quadrant up there. Nobody has profited from it as yet. It's sitting as part of the U.S. domestic reserve of uranium. They did all that to secure it. They never mined it because they didn't need it, because they could get uranium ore of a much richer grade in northern Alberta much more cheaply than they could bring the ore out of the ground and refine it in South Dakota. But in case they ever need it, they got it on hand. The issue is much broader than Pine Ridge, however. You're talking the 1868 treaty territory, which encompasses, among other things, I mean, it's about 3.5% of the aggregate land base of the lower 48. And if you compute it with the unceded territories, it's about 5%. So it's a huge domain, and it encompasses the entirety of the Black Hills, which has been considered, in some estimates, as the richest 100 square miles of geography on the entire planet. You've got the top 150 of the Fortune 500 all profiting out of that. And I mean, you want to name me one major energy corporation, and I'll just validate that they're there and they're making money out of it. But you've got a several billion dollar a year tourist industry, you've got a taxpayer subsidized ranching industry, you've got a Strategic Air Command, or what used to be Strategic Air Command, presence in the 68 territory, sufficient that if actually it was returned to the Lakotas tomorrow as a sovereign entity, that would be the third ranking nuclear power on the planet. Yeah, U.S. would still be number one with all that removed from its nuclear arsenal. Russia would still be number two, although the nukes may be dysfunctional, and then there's the Lakotas. Yeah. Yeah. So you've got all that kind of interest that's jackstrawed in there. Pine Ridge is only a piece of the puzzle. That's a part of the contraction. 90% of that territory has been stripped away in contravention of the terms of the treaty. See, that's a constitutional crime. Treaty once ratified under Article 6 of the United States Constitution is supreme law of the land, on par with the Constitution itself, because it's with another nation. Logically speaking, it cannot be subordinated to U.S. domestic legislation. So the abridgment of that treaty unilaterally is a constitutional level violation in the United States itself. You understand about that? The Constitution is a matter of optional compliance for the federal government in that area. It would be in every other area as well, as they keep proving, you know. So that's where that sits.
Strategy.
Well, the due process stuff pretty much is run out. They say you've got no judicial appeal prospects left. I would argue that despite this tacky little argument they made that, yeah, probably the feds are responsible for some of this, but Pelletier would be equally culpable, okay, doesn't play. So he's got a habeas corpus thing. And the reason I say it doesn't play is because his two co-defendants, the reason they say he was equally culpable is even if he hadn't shot them at close range, he'd still be culpable on the basis of having acknowledged that he participated in a longer range gunfight. Well, Bob Robidoux and Dino Butler also acknowledged that, and Robidoux went further and said he shot them both from long range, okay? And they were acquitted. So that does not imply, on that basis, equal culpability. But even if we were to accept the principle of equal culpability, if Leonard Pelletier is to stay in prison and being equally culpable with federal authorities, then why in the hell aren't those federal authorities sitting in the cells alongside him? Habeas corpus is still a valid thing, and the argument needs to be made. And habeas corpus simply means, if you can't tell us exactly why it is he's in prison, deliver the body. you are compelled to provide us with a formal explanation of the wrongdoing, the lawful conviction, or release the man. That's the nature of the principle, and it's a core principle of U.S. jurisprudence, so there should be an appeal on that basis. Whether it can be mounted, whether it be successful, I couldn't tell you. Another even more remote appeal possibility goes to incompetence of counsel, but that should have been done immediately after trial. Elliot Takeoff, the guy appointed, unfortunately, not by the court, but by our own defense committee to represent Peltier at trial, in his opening remarks conceded the murder occurred, which is the stupidest possible concession I could imagine. I mean, a jury had just found there was no murder, and Peltier's attorney concedes that there was. So it sets the whole thing back in motion. That's incompetency of a magnitude that's just staggering. But nobody filed appeal in a timely fashion, so it's questionable whether that could be entered. If Leonard were to be, because there is motion being made in the appeal process, or not the appeal process, the parole process, sorry. He was turned down in a parole hearing last year. They're trying to get that reopened. But there's a little problem with that. See, he's serving boxcars, so if they paroled him on the murder charge, the sentence he's serving, he'd simply start serving the next life sentence. And if they paroled him on both, he'd still be in prison because he escaped once, and so he's got double life plus 5 years at this point. Likelihood of a parole is not imminent. Well, Clinton made it pretty clear where things stand with commutation and pardon. You can rest assured that the guy who signed more execution orders than any governor in the United States in the last half century is not in all likelihood going to commute the sentence on Leonard Peltier. In fact, he's probably more inclined to want to get a post hoc reinterpretation of law so that Peltier could be bound under the Federal Death Penalty Act and executed. That's the way he deals with things like this. So that's not a likelihood. What is a likelihood? Well, I can't give you a concrete strategy, partly because it's not my place to do so. I'm not authorized to do so. I do not run a defense committee. I am not national spokesperson for Leonard Peltier at the present time. Hold his interests at heart, but I will not articulate his strategy to anyone. What I will say is that there is one principle that applies that neither the defense committee nor Leonard Peltier would disagree with, and that is these people only respond to things being rendered cost prohibitive. How it's rendered cost prohibitive to keep Leonard Peltier in prison is something maybe we could take some instruction from the Puerto Ricanos on. Puerto Rican independence movement made it more uncomfortable to keep their prisoners in prison than to let them out. And there's various ways you can go at that. How exactly they managed it in the particular instance that occurred in the last year, I don't know. I'm not privy to that, but it might do us some good to ask because they were successful. There's other examples that could be offered. But ultimately, he's got to be worth less to them, all right, on the street than he is in prison. Or it's got to cost more to keep him in prison than they're willing to pay. How can we extract that price? Well, this looks like a bright and imaginative group of people to me, so put your imaginations to work and figure it out for yourself. Like I said, I will
fear
not engage in sedition here in a public
arises
court.
Through the structure of thought. Thought, thinking about what happened yesterday, of which one is afraid, thinking about it, or thinking about the future, causes fear. Right? Thought breeds fear. No? Please, sirs, be quite sure. Don't accept what we're talking about, what the speaker is saying. Be absolutely sure for yourself that thought is there. Thinking about the pain, psychological pain one has had some time ago, and not wanting to repeat it again, or have that thing recalled or happen, and thought, thinking about all this breeds fear. Right? Can you go on from there? No, be because unless we see this very clearly, you won't be able to follow. Please don't ask questions yet. It's quite complex, this, so please, for the moment, just hold on to your question. No, don't hold on to your question. Drop your question, go on with it, what we're talking about. Thought, thinking about an incident, an experience, a state in which there has been a disturbance, danger, grief, pain, brings about fear. Thought, having established a certain security psychologically and not wanting that security to be disturbed, any disturbance is a resistance and therefore fear. So thought is responsible for fear. As thought is responsible for pleasure. Right? One has had a happy experience. Thought thinks about it and wants it repeated, perpetuated. And when that is not possible, there is a resistance, there is anger.
Drawing shapes onto the page. No, 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 not like that. Draw like this instead. Stop right there, start again. Cubism is dead. Paintbrush in thy hand. Realism, yet expressionism. It's all gone slightly pear-shaped. Some areas could be considered abstract. You've done it wrong, space cadet. Throw it in the bin. Start again. Write your teacher's name, that's Mr. Finn. Mr. Finn wouldn't suffer a fool. He wanted everybody to conform.
And thought his response.
With the formal painting methods he prescribed.
If there was no tomorrow or the next moment to think about either fear or
texture, form and color, then
neither exist.
Recreate the essence of depiction.
Go on from there.
Never trust
not, please bear in mind, not as an idea,
eyes,
but an actuality, a thing that you yourself have discovered.
Don't be crude, don't be brash,
and therefore real.
So
you say, by Jove, I've found out by yourself that
thought
breeds both these things.
And dreams are such deceptive.
You've had sexual enjoyment,
your mind,
pleasure.
Use your eyes. Neo-cubism is
then you think about
space cadet,
the image, the picture,
like
you know, business.
Mr. Finn had traveled all around.
And the very thinking about it gives strength
with a million
to that pleasure which you have had.
They came in many.
And when that is thwarted, there is pain,
declare,
anxiety, fear, jealousy,
but never
annoyance, anger, brutality.
If you can't paint art, leave my class.
Is the origin
is
of both. And we're not saying that you must not have pleasure. Bliss is not pleasure. Ecstasy is not brought about by thought. It's an entirely different thing. And you can only come upon that when you understand the nature of thought which breeds both pleasure and fear. And when a mind seeks bliss or ecstasy, and there is such a thing which is not pleasure, and to understand that there must be real inquiry and understanding of fear and pleasure, which is brought about by God. So, then the question arises, can one stop thought? You follow me? If thought breeds fear and pleasure, and where there is pleasure, there must be pain, which is fairly obvious. Then one asks oneself, can thought come to an end? Which doesn't mean the ending of perception of beauty, the enjoyment of beauty, like seeing the beauty of a flower, a tree, and enjoy totally, completely, fully. But when thought says, I must have that same experience tomorrow, that same delight which I had yesterday when I saw that cloud, that tree, that star, that face of that beautiful person, then it invites both disappointment, pain, fear, and pleasure tomorrow. Obviously. So the thought comes to an end. Or is that a wrong question altogether? It's the wrong question. Because we want to experience an ecstasy of bliss which is not pleasure. Therefore, you hope by ending thought, we come upon something which is immense, which is not the product of pleasure and fear. So then our question then is, what place has thought in life? Not how to end. What is the relationship of thought in action and in inaction? What is the relationship of thought where action is necessary? And why does thought come into existence at all when there is complete enjoyment of beauty? So that it doesn't carry it over tomorrow. I want to find out where thought is necessary. And it is necessary in action. And I also see that where there is complete enjoyment, beauty of the mountain, beauty of the waves, sheet of water, why should thought come there and give a twist to it and say, I must have that pleasure again tomorrow? So I have to find out what is the relationship of thought in action and thought must not interfere, which is when there is no action of thought at all. I see a beautiful tree and that's enough. And why should folk come in and say, well, I must have that same delight tomorrow? Now you also see that thought must operate in action. Skill in action is also skill in thought, which is really yoga, not merely physical exercise. Yoga also means skill in action, which we won't go into for the moment. So, what is the actual relationship between thought and action? Our action is now based on a concept, an idea. I have an idea or knowledge of what should be done. And what should be done is in approximation to the concept, to the idea, to the ideas. Right? So there is a division between action and the concept, the idea. This should be. In this division, there is conflict. Right? Any division, psychological division, must breed conflict. And I'm asking myself, what is the relationship of thought in action? If action is separated from the idea, then action is incomplete. Because in that, there is a separation, division, conflict. Therefore, action is incomplete. So, is there an action of thought which sees something instantly in the action, immediately? And therefore, no division, no conflict. And therefore, there is not an idea, an ideology, and something to be acted on separately. Right? Is there an action which is the very seeing is the act, and therefore the very thinking is the action? I see there is the perception that thought breeds fear and pleasure. And where there is pleasure, there must be pain. And therefore, resistance to pain. I see that very clearly. The seeing of it is the immediate action. And the seeing of it requires perceptions, thought, logic, thinking very clearly, all that is involved. And the seeing of it is instantaneous, and therefore the action is instantaneous. Therefore the freedom of action. That means you are a human being, a different human being, totally transformed. Not tomorrow, but now. Because you see very clearly that thought breeds both fear and pain and pleasure. And all our values are based on moral, ethical, social, religious, spiritual, all the values are based on. And if you see the truth, and to see the truth of it, you have to be astonishingly aware, logically, stealthily seem to observe him for this movement, then that very perception is total action. Therefore, when you leave, you are completely out of it. Otherwise, you will say, how am I to free of one? So, thought must operate in action. And it does. To go to your house, you must think. Catch the bus, train, and all the rest. Go to the office. More efficiently, more objectively, not personally, not emotionally, the more vital the thought is. But when thought carries on the experience that you have had as a delight, carries on through memory into the future, then such action is incomplete. Therefore, it is a form of resistance. And so, then to go on to the next question. Thought, what is, let's put it there, what is the origin of thought? And what is the think? One can see thought is the response of memory. Accumulated memory, knowledge, experience, the background from which there is a response to any challenge. Where you live, your art, there's instant response. And the memory, experience, knowledge, is the background of thought. But thought, which is always old, can never be changed. Express itself, but it is always old. Therefore, thought can never see anything new. When I understand that very clearly, the mind becomes far. Because life is a movement, constant movement in religion, and thought trying to capture that movement in terms of the past is afraid of me. And so, then the question is, see no fear. Seeing freedom is necessary to examine. And to examine very clearly, there must be the discipline of learning and not suppression and imitation. Seeing how the mind is conditioned by the past, by the past. And the mind, the brain, is the power. And all thought springing from that is old. And therefore it cannot possibly understand anything new. And to understand the mind must be completely quiet. Not control, not seek to be quiet. Now, seeing all that, actually seeing it, not theoretically, then there is an action from that perception or that very perception is the action of liberation from fear. Right? So when next...
This program has been brought to you by Resonance 104.4 FM. If you liked what you heard and want to support our work, please make a donation at fundraiser.resonance.fm.